29.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Gang activity can have a devastating cost in lives ruined and lives lost. So cities across the country have been working to spot gangs and shut them down. In Charlotte, CMPD has also been keeping their eye on gangs, but that's not all. They've tackled the problem creatively by coming up with alternatives to gang membership for at-risk kids. And today, we hear about a few of those efforts. Creative Loafing's Ryan Pitkin has been reporting on the progress being made in the Hidden Valley neighborhood in terms of reducing the influence of gangs on young people, and he joins us to talk about what he has uncovered. Good morning. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And we're also joined by two members of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Department to talk about their efforts to help at-risk kids find alternatives to gangs. Reverend Francis Cook is Community Relations Manager for CMPD and ran the department's Gang of One program before it was phased out in 2013. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And Sergeant Celestine Ratliff supervises the School Resources Office as well as the Juvenile Diversion Program for CMPD. Thank you for being here as well.
Thank you.
Let's start with Hidden Valley. This is a story that you spent a great deal of time on, evidently, because it was a long article focusing extensively on that area in Creative Loafing, Ryan. And you're not the first reporter to focus on that area. I had no idea till I read your article that, in fact, the History Channel devoted an hour-long episode to that neighborhood on their show called Gangland in 2009. Out of all the neighborhoods in all the country, why did the History Channel focus on Hidden Valley? Were things that bad?
Yeah, it was getting to that point. It was the sort of thing where there are a lot of different episodes, anything from motorcycle gangs in the Southwest to the Bloods and Crips to, you know, street gangs in Minnesota, and they just happened to come across Hidden Valley. It was the type of thing that really it set the neighborhood off as far as residents who live there not being happy with the way that their reputation was looking after a show like that comes out. Because it is, there's very proud people that live in that neighborhood. It's a suburb from the 1960s. A lot of people who live there are original homeowners or second generation homeowners. And it's a very low percentage of people who are criminals in that neighborhood. Obviously, it's under 1%. But when you watch an episode like that, it's titled Killing Snitches. There's action sequences about shootouts going down North Tryon Drive while cars are driving. Then people have to start dealing with the fact that they're looked at as being one of the most dangerous places in Charlotte, and they get looked at as living in this wasteland when that's not really the case. And that's when police had already started to take a stand against them. There were raids in 2008, which was a year before the episode aired. And then they picked back up in 2013. There was more action had to be taken, and that's where my article began.
And you are a freelance writer for Creative Loafing.
Yes.
So did you enterprise this story, or did they ask you to do it for them?
This was my idea. It sort of took place. I live in the Nodi area, which is sort of right next door, and I get off the Interstate 85 at the Sugar Creek Corridor almost every day. And I would look around, and I'd see I don't know if you're familiar with the show First 48 on A&E, but it's a true life homicide show, and it's taken place in Charlotte for a couple seasons. And I would see the cookout at that exit where one of the murders in that show took place, and I'd see a couple hotels that are on that corridor where some more episodes had taken place. And then you see Hidden Valley, where an hour-long episode of Gangland had taken place. And it was conversations that I was having with people as we drove down that road, like, that's where that episode took place, and that's where that episode took place. So the idea for the story sort of came as a sort of morbid tour of that.
Would it be accurate to say that when the History Channel did their expose on Hidden Valley, that the neighborhood was run by a gang?
In a certain sense, yes. I don't think citizens lived in complete fear. I don't think they were intimidated to the point where they didn't want to leave their house. A lot of them were completely fine. They would go about their business. A lot of the residents that I would talk to would just say that if you don't bother people that you know to be active in gangs, then they don't bother you. These people were selling drugs outside of their neighborhood, usually on that Sugar Creek corridor. And a lot of the residents there they really resented the gang because of the reputation they were giving them and the violence that would happen within there. They would drive by shootings and whatnot. But I don't think it was, it could be deemed like an unsafe place to live necessarily.
So how did it happen? How did gang activity flourish in that area? And why that area as opposed to some other area?
Right. It started in 1988 or 89, the late 80s. Two guys from Chicago moved down. They wanted to start a chapter of the Vice Lords, which is a big gang in Chicago. And they were rejected that permission, I guess, from higher ups in Chicago. So they started their own gang called the Kings. It stood for Knowledgeable Islamic Nubian Gods, I believe. That's changed over the years. And they focused on selling drugs, usually marijuana, sometimes cocaine and other things, usually marijuana, and the gun trade. They would use their money from selling drugs to trade guns, buy guns, sell them, use them. And I think that the best way to describe why that area, it obviously has something to do with luck, with not luck, but just the way that just getting those people in that area that came up with that idea.
So
but,
they could have settled someplace else in Charlotte.
Yeah, but there's also the fact that, and they talk about this in Gangland, that the way that neighborhood is set up, there's sort of one way in and one way out. So they set the neighborhood up into zones that they sort of call their own zone 1, zone 2, zone 3, and they are in that neighborhood doing whatever they do, whether it's drug sales or whatnot, prostitution, things like that. But they have watch out men who know every person who's coming in the neighborhood, any person who's coming out of the neighborhood. And I think that set them up to really sort of run the neighborhood.
CMPD, and you just said this a few minutes ago, CMPD knew about this problem. They had already begun to work on this problem prior to the program on television in 2009 and prior to some of the other things on A&E, which used to be the Arts and Entertainment Channel. I don't understand how that show made it on there. why didn't the police, whatever the police were doing in there in 2007, 2008, why didn't that just put an end to it?
Well, there were massive raids in 2008. That took out a lot of their leadership, sent them to prison for a long time. And the thing about the Hidden Valley Kings is they've always had this younger following, that 14, 13-year-old kids who are in middle school, high school, and are looking up to them as sort of their, I don't want to say role models, but that's what they are to them. And they sort of picked up the baton, and that's why it was years later, 2013, when these guys were old enough to really do some serious crime, that it sort of became an issue again, because there was a group of boys, the Northside Valley Boys, who were the younger version of the Hidden Valley Kings that started in 2004, and these kids were 13, 14, and they're actually called in a CMPD affidavit the AAA team of the Hidden Valley Kings.
So let me see if I understand this. When the police got involved and they rounded up these people in these massive raids and took them to trial, and many of them went to jail for a long time, these young kids in middle school at the time grew up and started their own version of this, and the problem had a resurgence.
Right, yeah.
Was that because we had Gang of One at one point. Was that because the police didn't understand that these young people were like gang members in waiting, and so they just let them do their thing, and it just bloomed as a result of that?
Reverend? No, not at all. As a matter of fact, at the same time that those interdictions were taking place by CMPD and the FBI, in support with the U.S. Attorney's Office, Gang of One was in the Hidden Valley Elementary School doing a Dangers Involved with Gangs program. We were in the middle school doing No Easy Walk, a peer leadership program. And the thing about gangs is that oftentimes you're swimming upstream against this cultural movement that celebrates what one might call this gang lifestyle, and the kids are enamored by it.
And why are they enamored by it? What is it about that lifestyle that makes them want to be part of it?
It's exciting. There's a place to belong.
But they just saw these guys.
They saw these guys.
Carted off to prison.
They saw these guys get carted off to prison, and yet to them, because they were their role models even at that time, the police were the bad guys taking them away. And it's hard to shift that perspective.
They also saw them a year later seen as stars of that Gangland show. And things like that make a big difference.
Yes,
in
and one can imagine that Gangland embellished the issue
right.
a bit and made it
one
look
be,
exciting.
One can be certain that they embellished.
Okay, yes, yes,
right.
Yes.
It's television. Are there no positive role models then to offset this when they see these guys who they look up to carted off to jail? Are there no positive role models to fill the vacuum, or are the positive role models simply too weak to fill the vacuum? They don't have the same luster that this exciting gang lifestyle seems to have.
I think that would be a great question to ask the kids, not only in that community, but just kids in general. But again, it's part of that youth development, and you're locked into this exciting person, what appears to be an exciting lifestyle.
Sergeant Ratliff, you deal with kids a lot as a school resources officer. Do you ever hear them talk about these people and why they seem to gravitate, some of them, not all of them, gravitate toward these folks?
Well, in listening to, first and foremost, I'm the school resource officer supervisor, so it's not school resources, it's the school resource officers, and we have 49 of them from CMPD that are spread amongst
also,
our middle and high school.
But you're also in charge of the juvenile diversion program.
Yes,
so
yes.
You deal with kids.
Yes, so. Yes. And what I see is typically the factors that draw kids into negative or illegal activity as a group, which, you know, basically is the most basic definition of gang activity, is, you know, a place to fit in, a place to belong. But what I'd like to speak to is I am a product of Hidden Valley. I grew up there. I went to Newell Elementary. I went to J.T. Williams Junior High School, and then I also went to West Charlotte. So I saw a lot of what was going on in that area. And to be quite honest with you, that emergence of that whole gang culture was really exacerbated by that program. So when you see someone on a nationally syndicated television show, they are elevated to like hero status. So when you ask why do kids join, if they see someone who is charismatic and someone who is, you know, being, you know, uplifted and you know, basically having their story told mm-hmm. on television, then you're going to find kids drawn to that.
Explain that to me, because as a kid, I watched all these shows like Outlaw Jesse James, and I didn't want to be Jesse James because Jesse James died in the end. And these guys die in the end, some of them. Or they certainly go to jail, and I don't want to go to jail. Jesse James went to jail, too. Why is that attractive?
Well, if you think about it, yes, he did die. Jesse James was not the most positive role model. However, you did find kids dressing up like Jesse James,
but it was make-believe.
And it was.
We didn't want to end up like Jesse James, and we knew that that's what happened. So, what's the difference?
Well, that behavior was still emulated. It was still imitated because this bad guy persona was on television. Same thing with, you know, John Wayne and some of these other, you know, action figures. Anytime you see it and then you see kids who are gravitating towards it and then imitating that activity, it's no different.
I think it's also important to note that you or other people emulating Jesse James didn't have people in their neighborhood that were Jesse James's telling them that they should join with them and right. become bank robbers.
Living right down the street.
Right.
We have to take a break. We're coming right back with more of this conversation in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and North Carolina Dance Theater's Cinderella, a dreams come true fairy tale ballet for all ages, tomorrow through the 16th at Knight Theater. Tickets at ncdance.org. And Creative Loafing, the Iron Fork Chef Competition, features five Charlotte chefs in a live cooking showdown, eats, drinks, and entertainment on Wednesday, March 19th. Tickets at clclt.com/events. Well, you know, Charlotte is amassing its share of social entrepreneurs, people with innovative solutions to pressing social problems. And two of those people are J.D. Lewis and Molly Barker. Molly started Girls on the Run years ago, and J.D. is the brains behind 12 in 12. They've both been on this program before individually. Now they've joined us. They're joining forces. And we're going to talk about that and the fact and about their work as social entrepreneurs and more tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, in his 2015 budget, President Obama calls for expanding tax breaks for low-income workers. Republicans are pushing welfare reform and an overhaul of social programs. Debate over government efforts to reduce poverty.
Join the conversation on the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks. On listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about gang activity and the police response to that and solutions or alternatives to gangs being presented by CMPD with Sergeant Celestine Ratliff, Supervisor of School Resources of the School Resources Office and the Juvenile Diversion Program at the Police Department, and Reverend Francis Cook, who is the Community Relations Manager there. Ryan Pitkin is a freelance writer for Creative Loafing who did an extensive article on Hidden Valley, a neighborhood that has been plagued with gangs for a long time. And as he reported, in the late 2008-2009, the problem seemed to decrease, and then it's increased as these young people who watched older gang members be carted off to jail became older and started a resurgence of gang activity, and the police responded to that activity, mm-hmm. and you reported on that. What was the neighborhood response, both to that increase in gang activity and to the police response to that increase in activity?
Well, their neighborhood response was to work with police, and they did a lot of work with lieutenants within that area, or one lieutenant was a main source for me who worked in what's called Zone 1 of the North Tryon Division, which is Hidden Valley and the Sugar Creek Corridor. And even all the way up to Chief Monroe, they requested more undercover work. They wanted to see stings happen in the neighborhood. I remember the language of one resident as quoted by the police, saying that we want more police in this neighborhood. We don't necessarily have to know that you're police. And that's what has been happening for the last 2 years. There's almost every other week there's undercover operations as far as selling drugs and or undercover operations for prostitution. And just trying to make that uncertainty within criminals' minds clear that we are always around and you don't know who you're going to be dealing
How
with.
How big is this operation? I know you can't talk about this with regard to the police because that's not your area of purview. Maybe you know unofficially some figures. How big is this operation or this effort on the part of the police to be undercover in these areas?
That would not be my area, and actually I couldn't speak to that.
Do you know,
undercover
Ryan?
Operations.
I can't give a number as far as officers involved or whatnot, but I think I know that it is a top priority of people within the North Tryon Division especially.
Is it pretty much centered in the Hidden Valley neighborhood, or are there other areas of town where these kinds of activities are also going on to thwart gangs?
It happens. I don't necessarily know if it's aimed at any certain gangs or whatnot, but it's definitely focused on that Sugar Creek corridor where Hidden Valley is.
Would the need for this kind of an operation and the fact that this kind of an operation is underway surprise most people, do you think?
Well, I think it probably would surprise people because the police department and the communities that we serve have been very intentional about their work to eradicate gangs from our community. And it's not public work. It's private, undercover, very intentional work. Mm-hmm. And what we've seen from the public perspective, with perhaps the exception of Hidden Valley, because of the rise there, is that the community is less concerned about gangs than it was 10 years ago, because the work of the gang unit, the work of Gang of One, the partnership with the communities, the U.S. Attorney's Office, Charlotte Mecklenburg Schools, we've worked really well in a comprehensive manner to bring a lot of this down a couple of notches. Mm-hmm. But the work continues.
I know that you talked to residents of the neighborhood. You talked to the police in, working in that neighborhood. Did you have a chance to talk to any of the gang members?
No, I wasn't able to. While I was doing my reporting, this new injunction that was passed in September, I believe, was just being implemented and discussed in court, and it sort of made being involved in the Hidden Valley Kings in any way illegal. So they sort of went under.
It's an interesting injunction. They got a court order. The police department got a court order banning the Hidden Valley Kings as an organization. They can't exist. And also, I think they gang members are banned from meeting anywhere at any time except for in church or at school. How has that worked out?
It seems to have dropped violent crime in the Hidden Valley neighborhood. There hasn't been quite as much. There has been some shootings here and there, but it's, for the most part, it's not running rampant like it was. There was a time from October 2012 to about July 2013, which sort of came to a head with the shooting of a 17-year-old boy doing an undercover drug deal in the Hidden Valley Elementary parking lot. And within that range, there was a lot of violent crime happening, and that sort of has slowed down a lot with the injunction. There's only been a couple of arrests for violating the injunction, but I think the awareness is really the more effective part of it, letting people know that you can catch a charge. You can be arrested for just being around certain people that you are – that are known affiliates.
So the crimes associated with gangs are drug dealing, prostitution, shootings, and murders.
Mostly it's with the Hidden Valley Kings, it's been drug dealing, marijuana, and property crime and armed robbery.
Okay.
For the most part.
So when we hear about crimes like that on the news in Hidden Valley and maybe other places, can we say probably that that's gang activity?
Yeah, I've had discussions with police who work that area. When you hear of a robbery that goes down on a late night, then they say we can't get view anything on the record about that particular crime. But usually, when it's people that age and people involved in that area on that street, then yeah, it's probably we're going to look at it as gang related.
So, do people who live, law-abiding citizens who have invited the police in because they want this to stop? Are those people living in fear, or are they fairly certain that since they don't directly deal with the gang members, they're not out buying drugs or going through some of the other stuff that the people approach these gang members for, and they're not members of the gang, that they themselves are fairly safe? They're not going to be targeted by the gang. They're not going to be gone after by the gangs. They're going to be safe. Or do they live in fear?
Most of the people I talk to do not live in fear at all. They're proud of their neighborhood. A lot of times they would just sort of brush off the Hidden Valley Kings as an old deal that they don't worry about anymore. A lot of them, a majority of the people I spoke to would tell me that most of the crime committed is from outsiders that come in. They'd all use the word outsiders. Not all, but most. Mm-hmm. And that sometimes is the case. A robbery that I reported about in my article about a food mart that's right there on Tom Hunter Road, which is in a border of Hidden Valley, was an outsider who didn't live within Hidden Valley. And people sort of, they get onto that point and they just tell people that everybody coming in to commit crimes is an outsider who doesn't live in Hidden Valley, which is not always the case, but sometimes is. Mm-hmm. And for the most part, I think they feel comfortable within their neighborhood, though.
You know, we've done a lot of shows about parents and kids and parents not always knowing what their children are up to. And we've done shows and other people have done programs on what signs to look for if your child is involved in drugs or in other illegal activities. Do most of the people whose kids end up being in these gangs know that their children are involved in these gangs and there's nothing they can do about it? Or does it come as a complete surprise to most of these people?
Well, just from my perspective, and I'm going to take a step back before I answer that.
Sure.
When you ask a question about people living in fear in that particular area, I've maintained contact with many people in Hidden Valley. And it's not so much living in fear. There's an annoyance because that is their neighborhood. This, you know, Hidden Valley does not belong to a gang. Hidden Valley, you know, is a very, it was a very prominent neighborhood, but I think a lot of the negative attention that's been placed on it has given it a more negative reputation than what is actually there.
And that negativity comes from?
Well, it comes from bringing a focus on a small percentage of people who are committing criminal activity, mm-hmm. and not focusing on the positives that people are doing there. People who are, you know, taking note of what their children are doing. People who are taking care of their property, who, you know, are educated and who are, you know, trying to make a difference and maintain.
And that impression comes from the media? The fact that we report, the media reports the bad things that happen, but not the good things that happen.
No. I think it's okay. The proportionality, just the sensationalizing some of the more negatives. I think Ryan said it whenever in the beginning of the show when he said a lot of the criminal activity in that large area, I mean, that is a huge area. Hidden Valley was one of the biggest neighborhoods in Charlotte that I knew of as I grew up. Mm-hmm. But just so many people compacted into one area, and there are so many positives there. But then you have one small faction that, you know, continually draw attention to what they're doing. And I really believe that, you know, the neighborhood is healing, and there are people who are still thriving, and they are really crying out to say, hey, look at the positives. Hidden Valley is not a very bad place. We don't like being called the most dangerous neighborhood in Charlotte, because if you really look at Charlotte in the totality, there are pockets of crime in different areas that if you really wanted to place a focus on it, you can find it anywhere.
Okay. But getting back to my question about parents, do they know for the most part that their kids are sometimes involved in these gang activities and they feel powerless to do anything about it, or does it come as a surprise to them?
Well, I can't say that all parents would feel that way. Some may, mm-hmm. Because they may not realize what their children are getting involved in. I can speak personally. My brother was approached when we were growing up, mm-hmm. when this whole gang mentality started formulating. And he said no, you know, because and we had an open communication as far as speaking, you know, talking with our parents. And then I think, you know, when you have a really good rapport with your children and parents are communicating with their kids and they're really focusing on what their kids are doing and talking to them every day, they have a better perspective. Now, there are some kids, no matter how good the parents are, no matter how much they talk to them and try to be involved, if a child is influenced outside the home, they can hide what they're doing.
Yeah. Francis Cook, you were the founding director and supervisor of CMPD's Gang of One Gang Prevention Unit, which operated from 2004 to 2013. It shut down at the end of last year. Why?
Well, it shut down for two reasons. One, the department had embarked upon a strategic planning to take a look at all of the different youth programs that it supported, Right Moves for Youth, the Police Activities League. There was a life skills programming within electronic monitoring. There was Gang of One, and a developing concern about diversion and just youth contact with the criminal justice system. And then we began to look at the different programs that were in different silos within the department, and we wanted to bring all of that together and begin looking at behaviors versus who's involved in what group, mm-hmm. including who's involved in gangs, who's not involved in gangs, but behaviors, activities that might lead one to join a gang. And so the department worked with an organization called Strategies for Youth over about a two-year period, met with community, met with folks internally, talked about what was best for the department, and these programs are all coming together under now what is called our Youth Engagement Unit. In particular to Gang of One, Gang of One was very focused on gangs, which we've all have said, considering the broad youth population that we have, that's a very narrow focus. How can we continue to work to prevent the recruitment of youth in gangs, mm-hmm. while expanding the work that we're doing in a more strategic way?
But your Gang of One had a proven track record. It busted up the MS-13 gang. It helped build a community center. It reached 12,000 kids a year through referrals from the courts and schools. And yet the money ran out and no one stepped up to refund.
Yeah, the money ran out. Another thing about Gang of One is Gang of One has been grant funded since 2004. Mm-hmm. It was not operated by funds within the department or from the city. It was total grant funds. And those grant funds, as often happen, ran out. But prior to those funds running out, the department was already preparing for the next steps with this youth engagement unit so that the work, yes, Gang of One impacted about 12,000 annually. Through this new youth engagement unit, we will impact even more.
So you really are sold on this. It's not, you're not just spinning this.
No, I'm not just spinning it. It really is a way for us to broaden our impact. And truth be told, you know, always an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. If we can get these kids before they join a gang, if we can divert them from the juvenile justice system, that's what we want to do.
And from what I can remember about Gang of One, it provided one-on-one contact with kids, correct?
Yes, yes. Yes, we had a case management program where we worked with very heavily gang-involved, criminally involved juveniles.
Does that kind of one-on-one contact, mentorship, whatever you want to call it, continue now in some form with the Youth Engagement Unit?
It will continue. It is not at the moment. We don't have case managers in place, mm-hmm. but the Department of Juvenile Justice does.
So what happened to all those kids you were working with in Gang of One? Where are they? Are they just out floating out there in space, or have they been taken up by somebody else or some other aspect of this program?
There's not a specific gang program like Gang of One out there, but there is case management through the juvenile justice system, and so those kids who are both criminally involved and gang involved have a court counselor who serves in a similar case manager role. We also have a strong partnership with Charlotte Community Services Association, and they have a gang alternative program. And so they are operating every weekend, meeting with these young people and also providing mentoring for them.
So the department took a look at this and did a study and worked with another organization to come up with this new youth engagement unit program. And I'm told that it was based on something called the Spurgle model.
Yes.
What is that?
Well, every good program is based upon good research, and this Spurgle model is actually applicable not only to crime overall, but gang crime in particular. You asked, you know, we got rid of Gang of One, we started this new thing, why would we do that? Well, the models and the lessons that we learned from Gang of One are applicable to this new unit. And so this Spurgle model says prevention is important. And if prevention doesn't work, then let's intervene. And if that doesn't work, yes, we're going to interdict and suppress. And when they come out of incarceration, we have an opportunity at reentry to intervene again to try to get folks back on the right path.
I want to talk about those five different points of entry in a second or two. But as a head of the juvenile diversion program, how do you interface with the youth engagement unit?
Well, we typically look at first-time offenders. Mm-hmm. It's when you're looking, you know, at some of the other models or some of the other steps within the youth engagement unit. My focus is the diversion piece. Mm-hmm. First-time offenders that are committing, you know, minor misdemeanor criminal activity. And when I say criminal activity, look at it this way: when kids are in school and they have a fight. That fight is considered to be a school violation, but then also it's a crime. It's also considered criminal activity. So our program focuses on bringing those kids in and giving them positive alternatives.
Sergeant Celestine Ratliff, who's the supervisor with the Juvenile Diversion Program at CMPD. We're coming right back with more. Stay with us. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Griffin Brothers Tire, Wheels, and Auto Repair, family-owned, serving the greater Charlotte area since 1961. 9 convenient locations featuring tire and automotive repair. Details at griffinbrothers.com. And Dr. Omar Shedd for Promise for Haiti and the Hospital de Beneficence, a nonprofit organization promoting health and providing health care in central Haiti. Visit PromiseForHaiti.org. In his 2015 budget, President Obama calls for expanding tax breaks for low-income workers. Republicans are pushing welfare reform and an overhaul of social programs. So, debate over government efforts to reduce poverty, the topic of the conversation, at 10 o'clock, 20 minutes from now, on The Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join our conversation, WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks is the place to start, and we're coming right back.
At WFAE, our job is to listen to you. You understand why we have pledge drives, but wish they didn't last so long. You've heard us say that more than half of our annual operating fund comes from listener contributions. Listening to you, we have a plan. Our goal this spring is to raise $650,000, and for every $65,000 raised before the drive begins, we'll eliminate a day. Please listen to us and make your pledge online at WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the gang activity and police response to that activity, and also youth working with young people to keep them out of gangs and, more importantly, keep them out of trouble, because not every kid who gets into trouble is in a gang. Let's be clear about that. Gang activity is fairly limited around town. Sergeant Celestine Ratliff is the supervisor of the School Resources Office and of the Juvenile Diversion Program within the police department, and Reverend Francis Cook is their community relations manager there. Ryan Pitkin is a freelance writer who wrote an article about the Hidden Valley neighborhood for Creative Loaf. Thing. And before I move on back into the what's happening now to help these kids, let's go back to Hidden Valley for just a couple of seconds, because we painted this picture of a problem big enough for CMPD to get PD to get involved with major roundups and, mm-hmm. and raids, not once but twice, maybe three or four times over, and now they're involved in undercover activity. Have things improved since all of this has been going on in Hidden Valley? Has the number of gang members, the number of gang activities decreased?
It's hard to say as far as the number of gang members, but I do think things have improved just on the stats alone. Violent crime, which is the one thing they were going after the most, obviously other than just disbanding the gang as a whole, but violent crime was the reason for all this, and that has gone down in the last 5 months since the injunction was passed against Hidden Valley Kings.
Now, the police department works with both at-risk young people, people who have not done anything mm-hmm. wrong, but who may do something wrong because of the role models that they choose to follow, and you deal with people who have already been involved in delinquent or criminal activity. Do those two groups mingle in the work that you do with them, or do you keep them separated? I'm just curious.
Well, speaking from diversion, we're dealing with a lower spectrum of juvenile. Well, we won't even call them juvenile offenders, but young people who have found themselves in situations. And the reason I say that is with youth diversion, it does address minor criminal activity, but then also when kids are beginning to make bad decisions. And
give me an example of that.
A bad decision might be pulling a fire alarm, okay? Or, because in the school environment, kids, can be tempted by peer pressure to do things that they wouldn't ordinarily do. Mm-hmm. I dare you to pull that. Mm-hmm. And, in pulling that fire alarm, it does generate a lot of resources that have to respond to that school. You've got, now you've got a police report. You've got everybody involved. And this one kid is going, well, I did it on a dare. Okay. That kid traditionally could enter the criminal justice system based upon that action. But our youth diversion program is designed to say, hey, that's not cool. Here is, one of our we'd like to put you in one of our programs that, really reemphasizes decision making and helping you to think through the consequences of your actions. And that's what youth diversion does. It just, addresses issues that are commonplace with kids when they're making these poor decisions that can eventually lead to more serious.
So when you're working with, and I'm not sure how you work with them. Maybe you can talk about how you work with these different populations of kids, because you work with everybody from kids who just have done nothing but are in an at-risk situation, or kids who have made unwise decisions, to kids who have robbed or sold drugs or maybe even involved in gang activity, some of whom have gone into the system and come back out. So are they all in the same group? Do they work together in sessions with you, or do you keep them apart?
The One, they're all youth, and they're all prone to making bad decisions. And what we're trying to do is to help them make better decisions, introduce them to more positive role models. And so your prevention work is us going out to different schools, to different congregations, to community events, and educating the public about gangs or bullying, or talking with the kids about anti-violence, the realities of gangs. And so it's an educational tool.
If gangs and gang activities are attractive because they are exciting and they come with certain amounts of bling attached and notoriety and perhaps even fame because they end up on television, how do you have cred with these kids? What do you say, what do you bring to the table that makes you as attractive as these other guys, these bad guys?
Well, one of the things that we do is let the kids educate themselves. We can't tell the kids, this is a bad guy, and he's going down the wrong street, and that's not the best place for you. But we can help them talk about their friend who was arrested, their friend who was injured, their friend who was killed, and say, well, maybe I really don't want to go in that direction. But then to your point, we've got to help provide an alternative to them. And so is it a sports activity? Is it a dance activity? Is it a drumming circle? Is it science? Is it racing? Is it technology? These are some of the programs that we're introducing at the prevention level to attract young people.
So let's go through this list of five different kinds of people that you focus on, and we'll begin with the kids who have no criminal record. Where do you find these kids? How do you identify these kids? And what are their lives like?
Well, these are the young people who are involved in our police activities leagues. They're involved at the YMCA, the YWCA. They're involved in Right Moves for Youth. These are young people who are engaged in positive programming and have a place to go.
But are these kids who have come to you, or do you actively go out and try to find them by combing through, school reports or talking to neighbors or thumbing through the number of kids who are on free lunch at school because they're considered at risk? How do you find them? Do you actually actively bring them into your programs or wait for them to come to you?
It may be a behavior that is noticed by teachers or maybe even our school resource officers, where a kid has not done anything necessarily criminal, but maybe, you know, hanging with a group of kids who are more involved or dealing or maybe involved in poor decision making. And, you know, we have gotten calls from officers that says, hey, this is a good kid. I'd like to see this kid continue on a positive path. Do you have any program that you can divert them to? Or do you have any information that can help them to make better choices? So that's prevention level, because we're identifying characteristics and behaviors in young people and trying to curb that and redirect in a positive, in a positive direction.
You know, there are lots of cop shows on television where the police are the heroes, and they are. But, I mean, they are the heroes. Is that at all attractive to these kids? I mean, you became a police officer, and you came from Hidden Valley. Is there something about that badge, that uniform, the fact that you are the boss when you're on the scene, that's attractive to these kids?
Well, you know, I do try and talk to young people about it. To be honest with you, in my generation, kids growing up in Hidden Valley, we grew up to be police officers, firefighters, social workers, teachers. We, you know, all seemed to have made a conscious choice to give back. That was one of the reasons that when I became a police officer, I wanted to be assigned back to that area so that I could give back to those who gave to me, those who encouraged me to be positive and to learn and to grow and to, you know, bring others up and mentor other young people. So in my 7 years as a DARE officer, I always made it a point to point out the positives. And I had a lot of positive feedback from young people who never thought about being a police officer. They might have thought, oh, I hate the police. And then after a semester of talking with them and opening up with them, you know, and just, you know, getting to know them and helping them to know me, You know, many of them indicated that they would like to now become police officers because they didn't realize it is pretty cool.
You have five levels of engagement to deal with all these different kinds of people: prevention, diversion, intervention, suppression, and reentry. Prevention and diversion sounds like two sides of the same coin. So explain the difference to me.
Well, they're both prevention. One is the education portion and connecting kids to programs, resources, activities, and peoples. And an element of prevention is the diversion, that recognition of behavior that then draws our attention and we plug them into, again, a positive program. Because what happens when the officer has the discretion not to arrest that kid, we meet one-on-one with that kid. We have people on staff in our diversion program who meet one-on-one with these young people and their families, and then they go to the Greenville Center and have 6 hours of programming where they dialogue with one another, they dialogue with the facilitators about decision-making, goal-setting, conflict resolution, family goals, and we try to help redirect everyone. And so they are two sides of the same coin.
So the people that you're dealing with in the prevention and diversion aspect of this are people who have not done anything or nothing serious at the moment. They may be, would they be some of the people that have made bad decisions, but nothing illegal, just that was a stupid thing to do, and we need to nip this in the bud?
Mm-hmm. Like characteristics and behaviors okay. that might lead, and then also like first-time offenders.
So level three. Oh, first-time offenders.
First-time offenders.
So level three is intervention, and you try to divert people from continued involvement in the criminal justice system. Are they new to your program, or are some of these people gone through the first two stages and still made a mistake and then come back to you into this intervention level? How does that work?
That does happen sometimes. There's no question about that. And that's why that intervention is important. You try to the prevention, you try to diversion, you do the best to get them on the right track, and you keep trying at the intervention level.
Do you have to, does this happen often, or are you pretty successful with the first two efforts to stop them from getting into trouble?
Now, we're tracking the data from diversion now, but so far it's pretty successful. It's more successful than intervention, to be honest. At intervention, you are doing well if you've got about a 65% rate that there's no further criminal activity from that young person. At diversion, I would estimate we're going to hit closer to 90%.
And when we talk about young people, what is the age range that we're talking about?
Between the ages of 6 and 17.
What happens to the kids who are 18, 19, 20?
We actually have some intervention work for them, but that's more focused at this point with the chronic offender. They're working with pretrial services or their own electronic monitoring, and we're providing life skills programming for them as well.
In the classroom, and we've done shows on this too, but in the classroom, if you lose a kid in the fourth grade, if they're academically, if they've fallen behind their peers and they can't keep up and school becomes a negative experience for them, if you've lost them, it's really hard to get them back and to bring them up to speed and get them through high school successfully. Is something similar going on here with behavior and crime? If you don't get them early, if they fall into a habit, is it hard to get them out of the hole?
Yes, absolutely. And it's better to start at those beginning stages where you're seeing some acting out and some risky behaviors.
Is there a correlation between a child who's not doing well in the classroom, for whom school has become a negative experience, and criminal activity? Because if school's not attractive, maybe I'll do this and I'll feel better about myself.
It's more common to find kids getting in trouble on a school level, being a disruption in class when they don't understand. Mm-hmm. But the most important thing is to identify that kid and realize what their learning style is. And it does take a bit more effort on, you know, as far as the teachers and the educators and those who are in support, part of the support staff at school, mm-hmm. to recognize these behaviors. But there are plans in place where these children can get back on track. So it's not impossible.
Now, you've also got kids in the suppression category who have, in fact, committed crimes. How do you motivate them to abandon that life that they've been living for a while and change their behavior? And how do you protect them from the negative peer pressure that they're bound to experience?
At that point, we have much less contact with the young person because mm-hmm. they've been held accountable for their action. And so that constructive work with them occurs at the youth development center. And when they are leaving that center, returning to Mecklenburg County, to Charlotte, that's when we and the Department of Juvenile Justice work together at times to help them so that they don't go back to exactly where they came and start back up that track again.
Why isn't one experience of being arrested and thrown into jail or thrown into some kind of a county lockup for 30 days, why isn't that enough to say, you know, I don't want to do this again? Because that can't be pretty. So, why isn't that enough for these kids to say, "Look, I got to find a better path. This cannot be my life."
I can speak to that. Okay. This is based upon my observation. The way that our society is set up is once you enter the criminal justice system, you are marked,
mm-hmm.
and that mark is going to follow you for the rest of your life.
Right.
So once our, you know, when the day a child turns 16 years old, they are charged as an adult. They are convicted as an adult. And they begin a criminal record that will follow them the rest of their lives. So if they have that going for them and they begin, you know, and it comes time to apply for colleges and it comes time to apply for jobs, it's really difficult to get someone to look at you seriously if you have those marks.
Should we change the system? Is 16 too young? We know now that young male brains don't completely gel until about 25 years old, and so they're going to make mistakes and do stupid things. Should we raise the age to at least 18?
Well, I can't speak to that as far as, you know, that procedure, and I would need to do a little bit more research on it, but I can tell you that right across the bridge in South Carolina, that age is 18.
Are you optimistic that this new program, this new approach, is going to have a positive impact?
Yes, absolutely.
And it's based on national standards. Are the national programs, what this has happened before, working as well as you hope this will work?
Yes, and we've got models of programming within those.
Reverend Francis Cook, who's Community Relations Manager of CMPD, Sergeant Celestine Ratliff, who's the Supervisor of the Juvenile Diversion Program there, and Ryan Pitkin with Creative Loafing. Thank you.